you are standing and expressing this is both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing educators and activists to campuses and communities across America to engage in meaningful dialogue about the pressing issues that confront our country and the world. If you enjoy the program, one way you can express your support is to become a monthly patron and sustainer of the show by signing up at www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. You can pledge as little as $2 a month or as much as you'd like, and not only know that you're supporting our efforts, but also gain access to bonus content, like premium commentaries on the events of the week, as well as signed books or DVDs. And all donations are tax deductible as they go directly to Speak Out to support their nonprofit activist mission. You can also make a one-time donation to the program at speakoutnow.org via PayPal, make sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. I am your host. And today I would like to talk about something, revisit something actually, that was in the news a few weeks ago. I did not have a chance to speak about it at the time, and it didn't receive perhaps as much attention as it should have or otherwise would have, because the story broke right in the midst of all the drama surrounding the confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. And so our attention as a nation was obviously focused on that confirmation and some of the surrounding issues regarding sexual assault and male sexual predation and misconduct. And so this story breaks, and it got some attention, but maybe not as much as it would have had that not been going on. I wanted to revisit it because I think it raises a number of important issues that we ought to be talking about. And what I'm speaking of in particular is the story that broke in the middle of those confirmation hearings, New York Times piece that looked at the Trump sort of family finances, if you will, and particularly looking at how Donald Trump came to be on a purely financial level, the individual that he is today. It was looking both at he and his immediate family, his children, for instance, now, who work with him, obviously, in the Trump organization, as well as looking backward at his parents, particularly Fred Trump, his father, and the way in which intergenerational transfers from father to son really paved the way for the growth of Donald Trump. Number one, it sort of sketched out the way in which Donald Trump inherited a lot more from his dad, Fred, than he has let on, which is important in sort of pulling apart the narrative of how Donald Trump is a self-made man, self-made billionaire. And the second piece had to do with various potentially illegal, but certainly unethical ways in which the Trump family avoided paying taxes that they otherwise would have owed. And the business press, you know, their reaction was to sort of yawn and say, oh, what do you know, rich people figuring out ways to avoid taxes, ho-hum, nothing to see here. Which, of course, ignores the fact that some of the things that were done could very well have been illegal. There may still be civil liability for them. So it's not a yawn and a ho-hum, or at least it ought not be. We ought not brush off the way that rich folks occasionally break the law in order to avoid paying taxes. But the bigger issue, really, even than the taxation piece, is what the story said about the way that Donald Trump owes his financial situation, not so much to hard work, certainly not to his own genius, but to the intergenerational transfers of wealth by his father to him, assets passed to him, money passed to him in the form of loans, but which weren't really loans, that were pretty much handouts from Fred to Donald. And what does that say, not only about Donald Trump's own personal narrative, but the larger issue of how wealthy people become wealthy and what does that mean for America and the way we understand class in this country. And, you know, this is important because Donald Trump has his narrative that he likes to spin, and it's important for us to pick apart that narrative, not just for him, but for a broader understanding of the issues in play. The story, of course, that Donald Trump would have the nation and the world believe, and certainly his followers and supporters, is that, of course, he became a billionaire by dint of his own brilliance, his own effort, his own hard work, his own perseverance, and, of course, his, quote, big brain, end of quote, about which he likes to pontificate at great length. And there has always been a counter-narrative to this. Even he acknowledged publicly that he had received a, quote, small $1 million loan, end of quote, from his father. That's, of course, not very small to most of us. Certainly suggests a head start that most Americans will not have not had. But, of course, that was an undersold number. Donald Trump, as I've pointed out many times, was really put in charge of the Trump business when it was worth hundreds of millions of dollars. So even if that money wasn't his directly, he had control over a portfolio worth well over $200 million in the 1970s and going into the 1980s, which is to say that he had at his disposal a lot of assets that he could use that he had not built up, that his father, who at one point was one of the wealthiest men in the country, had built up, and then used that to his advantage. If you have access to that portfolio, even if you have not quote-unquote inherited it yet because your father's not dead, you're able to use those assets to leverage loans, right, to get money from banks, to buy up other properties. So in effect, you know, we always, if we were paying attention, should have known that he was operating with hundreds of millions of dollars in, if you will, intergenerational transfers or head starts from Fred Trump, his dad. Now we know, thanks to the New York Times, that even the direct giving of money from Fred to Donald was far greater than perhaps we knew. According to this this exhaustive investigation in the Times, Fred Trump loaned directly to his son using various schemes that were really sort of covered up so as to avoid taxation. But what the research has found is that at least $63 million of direct loans to Donald from Fred, which were often hidden, but nonetheless very obvious if you unspool it as they have done, and really more like $400 million in loans, most of which were never repaid because they weren't really loans. I mean, what the Times has found is that, you know, they were sort of hidden as loans. They were called loans for tax purposes, but really there was never any intention of having that money paid back. In current dollars, we're talking $400 million worth of transfers. Donald Trump was receiving about $200,000 a year in current dollars in passive income when he was only 3 years old. So we're talking about now, what, we're talking about the early 1950s. He's already receiving passive income worth $200,000 at the age of three. Clearly, however big your brain, at the age of three, you're not really doing anything to deserve that money. By the time he was eight, which is to say, what, third grade, maybe fourth grade, third grade, Donald Trump is already a millionaire because of the way that the Trump family money was being put aside for him and perhaps for his other siblings as well, but certainly for him. And so we're talking about somebody who was a millionaire before they were out of elementary school, and yet he wants us to believe that he's just a hardworking schlub from Queens who has worked for everything that he has and has never really received help from anyone other than that small $1 million loan from his father. So just like everything else Donald Trump has said, it is a lie. It is just one more fabrication, one more falsehood. This is someone who, like the vast majority of super rich in this country, were born either into wealth or at least upper middle class status, giving them a head start relative to the vast majority of Americans. So this mythology of Donald Trump has been pierced. The problem being, of course, that his followers aren't going to believe the story anyway, because Donald Trump has done such a magnificent job at convincing millions of Americans that the mainstream press is all quote-unquote fake news, that they're just concocting this stuff. They're not going to read the information anyway. But what I want to talk about is not so much today the issue of Donald Trump's dishonesty about his origin story. If you actually believe that Donald Trump was a self-made billionaire, then you weren't paying attention from the beginning. This was, of course, just never true. And in fact, look, if you just look at Donald Trump's business record, most of the things things that he has touched have turned to shit. Like, if you, like, honestly, if you look at most of his businesses, they have failed. The only thing that ever worked for him consistently was the branding of his name, which was all about hype and showmanship. And I will give Donald Trump that. He is one hell of a salesperson when it comes to his name and when it comes to the image. But when you look at his real estate business, you know, it's been sort of up and down. He's had some hits. He's had a lot of misses. The casinos, of course, in Atlantic City failed miserably. His father had to come in at one point and buy over $3 million worth of casino chips just to keep the casino afloat. You think about all the other things, Trump University, Trump Stakes, Trump the board game, all of those things. None of these things really ever clicked. Most of the actual business ventures, other than the licensing of his name that he has entered into, have flopped. He's filed bankruptcy 6 times. United States banks were absolutely unwilling to lend him any more money. That's why he had to go to Russian oligarchs, apparently, and get money from abroad, because he couldn't get any here. In any event, I don't want to talk so much about Trump. I'm done with that. What I wanted to do was talk about how this story about the fabrication of Donald Trump's origin story relates to the larger issue of how we as Americans tend to understand the issue of class and class mobility or the lack thereof. Because it isn't just Donald Trump, is it, who believes that he is a self-made man, that he, you know, came from nothing and made something of himself. This is a much deeper and much more firmly entrenched myth than just among the Trump family. This is something that Americans writ large either already believe about themselves when they have become successful, by and large, or want to believe about their country if they haven't yet become successful. This notion of rugged individualism and the myth of meritocracy, the idea that the cream rises to the top and those who succeed do so because they have worked harder or they're just smarter or they have more innate talent, and those who sink and who don't make it, quote unquote, have failed to do so because of their own lack of effort, because of bad choices that they've made, or perhaps because they just don't have what it takes to be successful. We are very much wedded to this ideology in America, so much so that I think we could rightly refer to it, and I've said this many times before, as the secular gospel of the United States of America. It really is sort of equivalent to Genesis 1:1 of the Bible of Americanism, right? The idea that if you work hard, you can make it. If you didn't make it, it's because you didn't work hard. You need to try harder. And this is a very intoxicating ideology that affects a lot more than just the Donald Trumps of the world. It affects a lot of people, including people that aren't nearly as wealthy as Donald Trump, but just, you know, have a comfortable existence. They have a good, solid middle class or upper middle class lifestyle. They've got a little money in the bank. They got a nice house, they got a good job, you know, their kids are doing good, and there's a tendency for us to buy into the notion that whatever they have, by God, they earned it. And what I want to do today is sort of break this down a little bit and to talk about not only why that is untrue, and not just untrue for Donald Trump, as we now know, but why it is untrue more broadly in this country. The idea of meritocracy and rugged individualism is entirely mythical. Well, I won't say entirely, but largely mythical. And we need to understand that for a number of reasons that are both personal and structural. If we continue to adhere to this notion of rugged individualism and the myth of meritocratic advancement, we not only set ourselves up in a way that can be very dangerous as individuals with unrealistic expectations, but we also are more likely to create a society in which we do not attempt to generate equity and opportunity for others because we're so beholden to the notion that, well, if they just work hard, they'll do fine. We don't need to do anything as a society to create, you know, a level playing field or to create greater opportunity. It's all up to individuals. We end up with a less just, less decent, and frankly, less functional society when we adhere to that kind of mentality, as opposed to what would happen if we understood the role of pre-existing conditions that are largely beyond our control, factors of class, factors of race, for instance, as being paramount in determining who ends up where on the ladder. Because if we understand that, if we understand the role of pre-existing class advantage, if we understand the role of pre-existing white racial privilege and male privilege and all of these things, then we actually understand we have an obligation to do something to create equal opportunity. We can't just sit back and expect people to quote unquote do it on their own. And we also need to acknowledge, and this is even harder, as I'll explain in a second, we also need to acknowledge the role of luck. First, for the sake of humility, so we have a little bit of humility and true thankfulness for whatever it is that we've been able to accomplish because it could have gone the other way. And secondly, so that we will understand again the importance of creating opportunity for others. If part of what we have is the result not just of pre-existing class advantage, not just the existence of something like white privilege, but also just the outcome of lucky things that happen to us, the people that we happen to meet, the families into which we just so happened to be born that had certain connections or whatever else, that teacher in third grade who believed in us and pushed us, whatever it is, the mentors that we've had, none of which we have real control over. If those things have been instrumental in getting us to where we have to be, acknowledging that isn't only good for humility, it's also good because then that reminds us that sometimes we have to be the luck for someone else. We have to be that mentor. We have to be that teacher. We have to be that friend. We have to be that person who opens the door for someone else and provides opportunity for them the way that others did for us. It's this notion of reciprocity. And unfortunately, when we are beholden to the myth of meritocracy and the notion of rugged individualism, reciprocity goes out the door. If we would dispense with the notion of meritocracy and rugged individualism, we could create a much more just and equitable and frankly functional society, because it's very hard to look down on people who were struggling when you reject the notion of meritocracy, because now you're not blaming them for their condition. In fact, it's hard to look down on them because when you embrace the reality that much of that has to do with luck and circumstance beyond their control, you begin to realize you could be them. And you can't be too haughty about your own success because you realize that person who is, you know, selling fruit on the corner, that person could be you in a different set of circumstances, and you could be them. For people who are of faith, they might, you know, use that old phrase, "there but for the grace of God go I." If you're not a person of faith, you might not say it that way, but it's the same concept, right? It's the same notion, the same idea that essentially a lot of shit could have gone differently. And I think we could all do with a little dose of that reality. So first, let's have a discussion very briefly. I won't spend too much time on it, but I do want to point out some of the rather obvious evidence which demonstrates the falsity of the notion that people get what they deserve or what they earn. The reality is, in this country, that the top 0.1% of Americans, which is about 160,000 families, own about 22 to 25% of the nation's assets. And that is equal to the share of stuff, if you will, the national wealth, possessed by the poorest 90%. So 90% have the same amount as the top 0.1%. As of 2013, and I doubt this has changed very much, if anything, the number may have shrunk, you had about 30 people in this country that owned about $800 billion worth of assets, which was the same amount as the amount of assets owned by the poorest half of Americans, which was 157 million people. So 157 million people on one side, 30 people on the other, they got the same amount of stuff. Are we really supposed to believe that that was the result of hard work and what had been earned? From 2011 to 2014, and again, it's very unlikely this has changed, 9 of the wealthiest people in this country, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Mark Zuckerberg, the Koch brothers, the 4 principal Walton family heirs, that's the Walmart family, gained about $13 billion from capital gains on assets that they already had. It wasn't the result of new work. It wasn't a result of increased productivity. It wasn't a result of new discoveries or particular genius. They weren't working more hours. They just owned a bunch of stuff. And over that 3-year period, that stuff they owned became more valuable because of gains in the stock market. Now, if you consider that the median income for American workers that year was $51,000 in 2013, it would take a quarter of a million years, which is about 50,000 more than humans have even existed, for the typical American to earn as much as the average capital gain earned by just those 9 people since 2011. If you want to have a visual of what that means, if you were to take the typical American and stretch out your annual income in $1 bills from end to end, it would stretch somewhere around 26,000 feet. That's about a little under 5 miles. Over 3 years at the same income, those bills would now stretch about, you know, 15 miles, a little bit less than 15 miles. Meanwhile, if you were to take the median amount of money, median meaning half or above and half or below, so this is the midpoint, right? The median amount gained by those 9 people I just mentioned, those super rich Americans, over the same 3 years, and you were to stretch that money out in $1 bills from end to end, that chain of money would not only go farther than 15 miles, needless to say, which is what your money would stretch. That money chain would stretch 1.2 million miles. That is a money chain long enough to circle the Earth 48 times, or alternately to stretch from the Earth to the Moon and back twice, and then, having returned from the Moon, stretch around the globe a few more times just for good measure. You look just at the Walmart fortune. The Walmart heirs have as much wealth as the bottom 40% of Americans, or about 120 million people. So again, when we talk about meritocracy and rugged individualism in the abstract, it makes sense to people. You put it in these sort of concrete visual terms, and I think rational people begin to realize, okay, there's something about this that isn't really about merit. And of course, this is just aggregate data. This doesn't even break it down by race, where we know there are even other staggering discrepancies that have nothing to do with merit. According to the most recent data, and a lot of different folks keep this data, by the way. There are folks at Brandeis University who keep data on this. The Federal Reserve keeps data on this. And essentially what they all suggest is that the typical white family in America has about 14 or 15 times the net worth of the typical African-American family, about 8 to 10 times the net worth of the typical Latinx family. That certainly is not the result of hard work and effort. It is the outcome of an opportunity structure historically, which was skewed and allowed certain people called white to accumulate assets and to hand those down in greater numbers and to a greater extent than black and brown folks were able to do the same. It has really only been in the last few generations that African American families to any real extent were able to accumulate significant assets. Typically, white families are considerably more likely to be able to hand down money to their children and grandchildren, and the amount they are able to transfer is also quite a bit greater, whereas black families, for example, according to the research, are more likely, the children are more likely to actually be reaching back to help the parents and to help the grandparents, in part because the younger generation of African Americans, having had more opportunity, oftentimes more successful, feels an obligation to give back to the people who helped to raise them and get them where they are. So if anything, whereas inheritance sort of goes, or intergenerational transfers of wealth and assets and money go from older to younger, typically, and certainly in the white community. In black communities, it actually goes from younger to older. You got a lot of younger black folks helping to take care of their parents, helping to take care of multiple family members, keeping in mind, of course, that we always talk about the pathology of the black family, and yet that's a pretty good piece of evidence that might suggest the black family is quite a bit less pathological than the white family. A lot more camaraderie, a lot more closeness, a lot more sense of communal and mutual obligation there than in a lot of white families I know. But in any event, what that means is that the ability of black families to accumulate and to pass on wealth is less, having nothing to do with their effort. Back in 1996, and it was updated about a decade afterward in the mid-2000s, there was a great book, Black Wealth, White Wealth, by Melvin Oliver and Thomas Shapiro. And one of the things that they found, and which Shapiro then wrote about in a follow-up book, was that the typical young white couple coming out of college, if you compare them with the typical young black couple coming out of college, let's say both of them, you know, a young married couple, everybody's got a college degree, that the white couple typically will start out with about a $25,000 advantage, a head start in terms of net worth relative to the black family. And you may think, well, that's not that big a deal. But the reason it is a big deal is that that head start in net worth means, and usually it comes from, you know, parents helping with a down payment on a home, for instance, or the parents having, you know, paid for the college education so that the kids are not in debt. Think about that. If you're a young couple starting out and you're less likely to have college debt, or you don't have to pay mortgage insurance and you got help with the down payment, so you're not in the hole on your house the way that you would be if you had to do all that yourself, that is a significant head start. And wealth, unlike income, tends to accumulate much more rapidly, right? Assets actually expand and grow exponentially as a result of compound interest. And so if you've got an asset head start of $25,000 on year one, you know, 10 years down the line, you are likely to have a much bigger than $25,000 head start. So again, it has very little to do with merit, very little to do with hard work itself. In fact, right now, according to the research, The typical white family who has a household head who did not even finish high school, a dropout, has about one third more wealth on average than the typical black household headed by a college grad. Now, why is that? Well, again, it's the result of the cumulative effect of who has been able to accumulate and who has not. That white family, that white household, whose, you know, head of household didn't even finish high school, is more likely to have gotten a small house, maybe nothing fancy, but they were able to get a little property from their family, or maybe they're older and are going to be able to pass that household down to their kids in a way that older black folks will not be able to have done, whether they finished high school or didn't finish high school, whether they went to college or didn't go to college. This is what the evidence tells us, all of which mitigates against the idea that we live in a truly meritocratic society. Of course, in response to this, others will say, well, yes, all of that is true, but you're ignoring mobility, Tim. You're ignoring the fact that even if you start out with very little, there's always the opportunity to move up. But the question is, how likely is it to actually move up? What does it look like in terms of upward mobility in the United States? Well, according to the Global Wealth Data Book, the likelihood of persons moving up in the wealth distribution is actually lower in this country than in any other industrialized nation. So actual upward mobility is lower in the United States than in the industrialized nations with which we like to compare ourselves. The evidence suggests that in nations that have greater inequality, in fact, like ours, they have less intergenerational mobility. You actually have more mobility in more egalitarian societies like Finland, Denmark, Sweden, Norway. Although it's true that most kids who were born into the poorest fifth of American families will make it into a higher level as adults, about 4 out of 10 will not. Then even those who do manage to move up don't move much. 60% of people who are born poor are going to remain in the lowest two-fifths. That is to say, the lower working class, lower middle class, or still poor. Only 1 out of 10 who were born poor are going to make it into the top 20%. In other words, there just isn't a lot of fluctuation. When you're born at the bottom, you tend to stay at the bottom or the near bottom. When you're born at the top, you tend to stay at the top or the near top. So again, this notion of mobility simply does not really hold water the way that we would like for it to hold water. And yet it remains a very prominent idea in our society. Why does it do that? Well, I think we know the answer to that question. It's actually a very understandable mythology because on the one hand, we want to feel as though we deserve what we have if we're doing well, right? That is an ego boost for us. So if we've been successful, if we've made something of ourselves, if we're doing okay financially, if we're, you know, professionally at the top of our game in terms of our occupational status, etc., it is an ego boost. It is ego enhancing to believe that we deserve that and that that's the result of our own hard work. And by the same token, if we are struggling, we also want to believe it because we want to think that if we just work a little harder, we could be doing better because that gives us a sense of efficacy, of self-control, that we're the captain of our own ship. It gives us a sense of agency, right? And frankly, that's a lot easier for us sometimes than accepting the notion that maybe we got some things undeservedly, because if we accept that maybe we had some unearned advantages due to race or class or something like that, that could induce a certain degree of guilt. Now we feel bad. Oh my God, we don't want to feel bad. So we push that away. And if we accept the role of luck in our lives, that's even more frightening, I think, right? Because if you accept the role of luck, then that can induce fear that if our luck is implicated in our success, then oh my God, our luck could turn bad, right? And then where would we be? Like we had all this good luck, and that explains why we're doing well. Holy shit, what if, you know, Thursday things go south? And so we don't want to accept the notion of luck because luck seems so incredibly random, right? It's not something over which we have control, and therefore we're always sort of, you know, waiting for the other shoe to drop. So the myth of meritocracy and rugged individualism is very alluring, it's very intoxicating, and it's really quite genius if you think about it as an ideology. If you are wanting to keep, you know, if you're sort of running stuff in a society, if you're the elite, if you're the powerful group, let's say going back to the colonial period in the United States, and you want to keep what you have, right? You don't want to share it. That's not really your thing, right? And you're wanting to maintain these hierarchies of, well, just take race out of the equation altogether for a second. You just want to maintain economic hierarchy, right? You just want to maintain your power. The best way in the world that you can do that is to craft an ideology and a narrative and to push that ideology and narrative into the public sphere that says that whatever you put in is what you're going to get out, and whatever you get out is the result of what you put in, and it's all about your own initiative and rugged individualism and making good choices. That's a genius ideology if you want to rationalize the disparities that already exist and make sure that people won't fight to change them. Because if you look at, you know, you think about the European monarchies and feudal systems that quote unquote white people came from, those who ended up, creating the infrastructure, ideological infrastructure for the United States. These are people who came from societies that didn't even pretend to be meritocratic, right? I mean, if you were living in England or you were living in France or whatever, you were living in any of these feudal systems, you were either related to royalty or you were not. And if you were, you were going to receive certain favor and certain opportunity. And if you weren't, if you were peasant class. There was no way that you could work your way into the elite, right? You weren't. You were going to be a peasant. And if you were elite and royal, you were going to be elite and royal. And as a result, it was very easy for people to sort of understand the class lines that existed. And as a result, you had revolutions or revolutionary movements quite often because the poor understood the only way that they were going to get a better deal was to overthrow the system. So the peasants in France had to overthrow the king and try to abolish the feudal system and the monarchy if they wanted to get a better deal. That became the only way to really change it. You weren't going to be able to work your way into Versailles, right? Same thing in England and any other feudal system. But in the United States, you create the idea that, you know, every man a king. Everyone can, you know, make it if they just work hard. It's a very intoxicating ideology, and it's one that sort of takes the legs out of class struggle in a lot of ways, and certainly makes it harder to engage in class struggle because, A, you don't even see the need to do it because you're rationalizing the inequalities that you see, and B, even if you think it might be unfair, you're encouraged to believe that you can be the king, that you can be the top guy, that you can be the boss, the one running things. So why would you want to create greater equality now? Because if you just work hard 5-10 years from now, you'll be on top and you wouldn't want equality then. So it is this incredibly closed circle ideologically that serves to maintain existing power disparities. And it does so by playing upon the psychology that self-help always plays upon. And the psychology of self-help, again, makes us feel powerful, makes us feel effective, makes us feel like we have agency, which is what human beings want to feel. We don't want to feel adrift. We don't want to feel helpless. But it ends up being very dangerous. On the one hand, it's obviously dangerous for the people on the bottom, right? If you have this ideology and you're struggling and you internalize that ideology such that you don't fight to change the system because you figure the system can't be changed or it's not worth the struggle, then it's obviously very dangerous and debilitating for you. But I want to suggest that it's actually not real healthy for anyone, that in the long run, it can be very debilitating for really anyone unless you're in that top 1%. I mean, if you're really at the pinnacle, then all the stuff I'm about to say, you know, you could just go ahead and stop, you know, stop listening. There's probably no point. But anyone else who isn't sort of in that elite, I'm telling you, it can be very dangerous. Think about it. If you internalize the belief that wherever you end up is all about you, and maybe you're doing well for a really long time, right? Maybe you're successful. Maybe you get some early success right out the gate after college, graduate school, whatever it is. And then for whatever reason, it could be a health setback. It could be that you get laid off because the economy takes a nosedive. Things do happen to us. But if you're just sort of comfortable, you're solidly middle class, maybe a little upper middle class, you're doing well, and all of a sudden you get laid off, or you have a health emergency or something happens, the economy takes a downturn, as it did, you know, with the recession. And a lot of middle-class families got hammered in that recession who didn't think that it would happen to them. Now what happens psychologically to you? We know what happens to you financially. You're in a bind, and we know the stress that that creates, both mentally, emotionally, and physically on a person. But think about the psychological effect simply of struggling when you haven't been struggling before because you've been successful. And that whole time that you were successful, if you were telling yourself, this is the result of my own effort, this is because of my character, this is because of my work ethic, and now all of a sudden you're not doing so well, how do you explain that? If you're not accepting systemic reasons for your success, because that would take away from your rugged individualism narrative, then you're not going to accept systemic explanations for your failure. So if all of a sudden you're struggling, you can't make your bills, you got laid off, you're having a hard time finding another job, maybe you're in your 50s, and you know, it's hard, man. When you're a little older and you lose your job because of downsizing or outsourcing or the economy takes a nosedive, it's hard to find new work because a lot of companies would rather hire someone in their 20s. It's not going to cost them as much in salary, and it's certainly not going to cost them as much in terms of healthcare costs if they're paying a portion of those. So all of a sudden you're struggling and you've rejected systemic explanations for where people end up because you wanted to claim credit for your previous success. Now you're stuck because now you have accepted that individualistic narrative. And now the only way that you can really explain to yourself your own struggle is that you must be doing something wrong. You just need to go out there and try harder. You must have the wrong attitude. And that begins to eat away at you. So now you end up sort of sinking in a shame spiral of what have I done? What am I not doing right? Now you've got shame. Now you're blaming yourself. Now there's a certain degree of self-hatred that sets in, none of which is going to be healthy for you. None of which is going to be healthy for your family. If you want to understand, for instance, the opioid crisis, and I've talked about this many times before, the opioid crisis in America, and particularly in white America, which is where it is disproportionately hitting, white, rural, and small town America, where a lot of these communities are dying, the factories have closed, the plants have gone, the economic opportunity has dried up, and by the way, in those areas, it hasn't really changed because of Donald Trump. Most of the job growth, economic growth happening during this administration, happening in the very metropolitan areas where he didn't get the votes. In the metropolitan areas that he said got all the attention, they're still the ones who were benefiting the most, not the rural areas that he said were forgotten. They're still struggling. Those jobs still haven't come back, and by and large, they're not going to. And the problem is, if you're growing up in one of those spaces and you have bought into the American narrative, man, you have bought into it because for so many generations, it sort of worked for people in those communities, right? Because they did have jobs and they could take for granted that even if they didn't climb the ladder, they'd have horizontal mobility. My daddy worked in the mine. I'm working in the mine. My son will work in the mine. Or, you know, my grandfather worked in the factory. So did my daddy. So am I. You know, that notion that if you're just willing to work hard and you got a strong back and you can lift stuff, everything will be okay. If you were white in America and even working class living in one of those small towns, you could really believe that. Now, if you were black, you sort of knew that was bullshit. Like, black and brown folks never could take for granted that hard work and a good attitude was going to be enough because they understood based on their own history that it had not been enough. But if you were white, you could really buy into it. And so, and as long as stuff was going fine, right, for you and yours, buying into that wasn't a big problem. It was fine. It actually pumped you up. But the minute that things go to shit and you're struggling and you can't find work and your town is dying and you've bought into that rugged individualistic mentality that black and brown folks always sort of looked at with a little bit of side eye, understanding that it was at best a half-truth, at worst an outright fraud, you're going to be the one, that white person who's bought into that mentality, who internalizes that shame. And what do you do when you internalize that shame? It becomes a lot easier, doesn't it, to destroy yourself. It becomes a lot easier to pick up that bottle and drink yourself to death. So we've had a big spike in cirrhosis of the liver brought on by heavy drinking, particularly in white communities. It becomes a lot easier to put that gun in your mouth. We've had a major rise in suicides among working class, non-college educated, middle-aged white people. And it becomes a lot easier to start using those opioids, whether it's oxy, whether it's fentanyl, whether it's street heroin, to numb the pain, to block the pain that you're experiencing, not just perhaps physical pain, but emotional pain as well. And so part of the reason that we see this increasing problem in small town white America among working class, non-college educated, and middle-aged white people is because these are the very people who are the least prepared to deal with setback, because they were the very people who were most likely to buy the myth of meritocracy. Do you understand what I'm saying? When you buy that myth, the people who are most bought into that thinking, who are in fact white and who are in fact male, and maybe quote unquote middle class, right? The really poor white folks oftentimes don't buy it, but the upper working and the middle class really do, because it tends to work for them. They have just enough evidence, right, that hard work pays off. They have just enough evidence that they can latch onto it. But then when things go badly, they're stuck. Now it's like a dagger pointed at the heart of those very same people, because they bought the mentality and now they have no one to blame but themselves. If they'd had a systemic way of looking at things, that might not have happened. If they had listened to black and brown folks tell them that the system isn't really all it's cracked up to be, then this wouldn't have been such a psychological setback. They would be able to then think systemically and structurally and maybe join with people of color in solidarity to fight for a better system for all working people. But if I've bought into the mentality that it's all about me and where you are is all about you, when I'm suddenly struggling, I'm going to internalize that blame and I'm going to internalize that shame. And then the only choices I've got are to destroy myself, or perhaps I can externalize it and try to blame someone else. I can blame brown folks coming over the border. I can blame black folks for quote unquote taking my job. But the reality is none of that blaming of other people is actually going to make me any better off, right? Blaming brown folks is not going to create a job. Building the wall, even if that were feasible, that's not going to create any jobs, because capitalism means capital will always be on the move, man. Capital is going to cross borders no matter what your happy ass wants. You may want to close the border to workers, but all you're doing is blocking labor mobility. You're not blocking capital mobility. Capital will still leave the United States and go elsewhere in search of the lowest wage and the lowest unit labor cost. Goods are going to continue to cross borders in search of the highest price for whatever it is that's being sold. If you allow capital and goods to move, but you chain labor to its country of origin, basic economics tells you that you have shifted the balance of power even greater in favor of capital and against workers. And not just workers who are brown, but workers who are white, not just workers south of the United States border, but workers in the United States as well. So none of this is really going to solve the problem. You either have to scapegoat, which isn't going to make things better, or you have to kill yourself, which isn't going to make things better. The third option, which we don't end up looking into because we've bought into the myth of meritocracy, is the option of solidarity, is the option of reciprocity, is the idea that maybe I ought to join together with these other folks who have known the system was a scam for multiple generations and try to fight for a better deal for all. So that's why I say that the notion of rugged individualism and the myth of meritocracy is incredibly dangerous for the vast majority of people to internalize. But then the question is, how do we get free from it, right? Because it's one thing to present the data, and yet that doesn't really move the needle because we are so bought into the narrative. It's very hard to fight a narrative that is so deeply ingrained in the ideology and the philosophy of the country, almost like a religious belief, with facts and data and statistics. But I do think it is possible to push back against the notion of rugged individualism and the myth of meritocracy with our own counter-narrative that is about storytelling and about sharing personal experiences, because that is the kind of stuff that actually moves us. Humans are wired evolutionarily to respond to stories. Going back to the very earliest humans, really storytelling was far more common and prevalent, and our brains are much more wired for that than they are for academic research with multiple regression analysis, right? That is not the brain is not wired for that. It can do that. It can learn to do that, but that's a process. Storytelling, on the other hand, is something that all human beings, when they reach a certain age, are capable of doing. And the reason that the myth of meritocracy and the notion of rugged individualism is so ingrained is not because the evidence has suggested it was real, by and large, but because the storytellers who have made that the dominant narrative have been better, have been more effective. Donald Trump is a good example of that. He's told this lie, which has been able to exist for he and his own family for so long that it has become a type of gospel, not only for him, but for people who support him. We as a country have done that for so long. And again, like I said, it appeals to certain psychological needs that it has become not just the dominant narrative, but a form of religiosity. So if we're going to respond to that, if we're going to move from that myth of meritocracy to a society of solidarity, we're going to have to tell different and better stories. What does that look like? Well, first of all, the best story that you're ever able to tell is your own. The reason that's important, and I'm going to demonstrate how to do this in a second, is because if I am willing to acknowledge my own unearned position in the society, if I'm willing to acknowledge my own pre-existing advantages, whether those are racial or economic or gendered or whatever they might be, two things happen. Number one is that I am putting forward a narrative that demonstrates in very visual terms and storytelling terms why the notion of meritocracy is a myth. So that has its own sort of meta-narrative power and mimetic force, if you will, right? But the second reason it's very valuable is it makes it less frightening for the person to whom I'm speaking or trying to persuade. It makes it less frightening for them to also acknowledge how they might have benefited from unearned advantages or luck, which is also very important. No one wants to admit that first, right? Because if I admit it, it's really frightening. But if you admit it first to me and you demonstrate that you're not afraid to acknowledge it, you're not afraid to own the way that luck has played a role in your life, then that gives me a little bit more permission. And I'm not as afraid because I can see that you're not afraid. So it's about modeling that level of humility and demonstrating how it can be done. And I know this might not seem like a movement strategy because really it is a rhetorical and a narrative strategy, but movement building does require good storytelling. You don't build movements on the basis of radical political ideology that you learn in a critical race theory class or an intersectional feminist class. That's just not going to be the basis for movement building. Movement building has never been based out of academia. It has never grown from like the overly intellectual spaces within the society. It usually grows from the grassroots. And these are folks who talk in very plain terms and tell their own life story. The civil rights movement was made powerful by the lived experiences of Black and brown folks in this country. The labor movement was made powerful, at least for a time, by by the recitation of the lived experience of working people, and frankly, some of the narratives that were crafted, let's say during the Great Depression, by some of our nation's greatest novelists who wrote about the folks in the Dust Bowl, who wrote about the folks who were riding the rails, folk singers who literally wrote songs about hobos who were considered types of national heroes. They weren't looked at as bums. They weren't looked at as worthless and shiftless. You know, it was understood that there was this larger systemic reality creating dislocation of workers. So storytelling does, in fact, help build and sustain movements. So how might we do it? Really, the best story you can tell is your own story and how you got to where you are. So let me, and many of you will have heard this, but let me just break it down for you. And let me say, when I tell this story and when you tell yours, it isn't about disabusing the notion of hard work. It doesn't mean that the person who admits to having had some unearned advantage or even luck hasn't worked hard. You know, I think most people in hyper-competitive societies work hard because they just don't have a hell of a lot of choice. If you don't work hard, you really will sink in a hyper-competitive society a lot of times. I don't want you to think that I'm saying hard work has nothing to do with it. And obviously, look, hard work, if it's something you love, can also be incredibly rewarding on its own level, regardless of how far you make it financially. I'm just saying that acknowledging the things about our position and our station in life that aren't about hard work is an incredibly valuable political exercise. So here's how it works for me. So I have been doing civil rights and anti-racism work on a professional level now as a job since I was 21, 22 years old. I graduated college in 1990. And shortly after that, began work in this field in the campaigns against David Duke in Louisiana when he was running for the Senate and then for governor in 1991. David Duke, of course, for those who don't know the name, former Klan leader and one of the most prominent white supremacists in United States history, both then and now, and for really four decades or more. And I did this right out of college. I was 21. I didn't turn 22 until October, actually a couple days before the Senate election. So I was doing that work professionally from the time I'm 21 years old. So now 29 years. And because that campaign was a very high profile thing, right, to have a Nazi, a white supremacist, almost winning a U.S. Senate seat and then almost winning the governor's race the year later, got 44% of the vote in the Senate race, 39% in the governor's race. In both races, got the majority of white voters, 60% of white voters in the Senate race, 55% in the governor's race. So very clearly a big deal, right, that someone like David Duke could get those kind of numbers, 650,000 votes in both elections or more. And so that catapulted those of us who were involved in that effort, obviously, to a national level of prominence that we otherwise probably would not have had, because you had journalists from all over the world, not just the United States, coming around asking questions about what was going on. And because I was centrally involved in that as one of the principal people, I was being interviewed a lot. I was being asked a lot of questions about this particular topic, and I was coming to a certain degree of national attention, without which it is highly unlikely that I end up getting out on the lecture circuit a few years later, about 5 years after, and then doing the work that I'm doing now and getting the book deals and becoming prominent in this field. And then the question is, how did I get that job, right? Now, the meritocratic narrative would say, well, I was the most qualified person for it. Well, I don't know if I was or not, and I don't even know how we would objectively determine that. What I do know is that I knew the two guys who founded the organization that was the principal opposition group to David Duke. One of them was a history professor of mine, and the other was a graduate student at Tulane University in New Orleans, where I had gone as an undergrad, and he was a buddy of mine. So they offered me the job right out of college because they knew me, they respected my work as an activist in college, but it's not like there was some huge open competition where everybody sent in their resumes and they objectively evaluated everyone. I got the gig because I knew the two guys who had the job to offer. I actually turned it down initially and it went to someone else, but then I came back to New Orleans over the summer knowing that the person that they had hired was going to be heading back to college herself, and she was a Yale student, and I knew the job would come open. So I came back and I took advantage of the fact that I knew these guys and I got the gig. Now, that then begs the question, how did I know them? Well, obviously, I only knew them because I had gone to Tulane. If I had gone to any other college in this country, I wouldn't have met them. And regardless of my views or my interest in the issue of racism, I wouldn't have been in a position to get the job fighting David Duke, in which case I don't build up this national reputation, certainly not as early as I did. And my whole life is going to be different in terms of the trajectory of my professional success. Well, the only reason I got got to Tulane are a couple of aspects of that story. One is about unearned advantage, and one is about luck. First, the unearned advantage piece. As anyone who's read my my memoir, White Like Me, knows, and you may have heard me talk about this in speeches, I certainly didn't grow up with class privilege. I grew up in a 850-square-foot apartment in Nashville, and it's an apartment in which I lived from the time I was 3 days old until the day I went out the door to go to college. So we didn't have any collateral. We didn't have any assets. We didn't have any credit that wasn't bad credit. We were in debt most of my life. We didn't have money for vacations. And so when it came time to go to college, the good news is, of course, if you're broke, you can get all these loans and you can get financial aid. The problem is, if you're Tim Wise, you're very good at procrastination. That's one of your better skills. And so I got my financial aid forms in incredibly late to Tulane. And as a result, even though I was accepted to the school, they wrote me a letter in the summer before I was to begin saying, congratulations, you've been accepted. And we've got about $8,000 in financial aid that we can offer you. You got your forms in late, but we want to try to meet some of your need. Here's $8,000. And basically, you know, you're going to have to come up with the rest. Well, the rest in 1986 was about $12,000 more. It was going to be about $20,000 for tuition and fees and room and board and all that stuff. Of course, that's a bargain by today's standards. It's well over 50 today. I think it's close to 60. But at the time, it was going to be about 20, and they only were giving me eight. So we were going to have to come up with 12, but we didn't have $12,000, right? We didn't have that kind of money sitting around. But my mom is able to go to the bank and get a loan for $12,000. How did she do that? Well, very simply, she went down and got her mother, my grandmother, to co-sign the loan and put her house up as collateral against the loan. It was the fourth or fifth house that my grandmother had owned with my grandfather, who'd been dead for 6 years by that point. But it was the fourth or fifth house that she and he had owned. And in each of those cases, the first house they had bought back in like the mid-1950s, late 1950s. They had bought that with the money my grandfather had made in the civil service and before that in the military. And they had gotten it for relatively cheap. They paid it off relatively quick and continued to get their other houses essentially with cash. These were houses in neighborhoods that they would never have been able to buy into had they been anything but white because of residential segregation. That very first house they wouldn't have been able to get the loan for had they been anything but white. The jobs that my grandfather had that made it possible for him to pay for those houses, which were not palatial by any stretch of the imagination, but they were good, solid middle-class homes in the 50s and 60s. The jobs he had that made that possible, both as an officer in the military and then the civil service gigs he had. Again, you don't get rich doing either of those, but if you were white in those days, you were going to be able to get a far better gig in civil service and or the military than if you'd been black or brown. So literally, the house that my grandmother uses as collateral so that my mother can get the $12,000 loan so that I can go to Tulane is procured in large measure on the back of our family's whiteness. If we're not white, we're not likely to have that house. They are not likely to have had the houses going back at that point 30 or more years that they had had in order for me to get that loan and be able to go to that school. And if I don't go to that school, I don't meet those guys. They don't give me that job. I don't fight David Duke, build up a national reputation, and end up where I am today. So that's not to make me feel bad. It's not to say that I did not quote unquote earn my way into Tulane, whatever that means. But my ability to actually go to Tulane had something to do with something very much outside of my control and very much unearned. Now here's the luck piece, and this is even bigger and I think more instructive. The only reason I went to Tulane, and I've joked about this many times, the only reason I went to Tulane is that I was chasing a girl who was going to LSU, Louisiana State, and it was someone I met at a summer debate camp in Washington, D.C. at American University in the summer of 1985, the year before our senior years. This young woman was a student in Lafayette, Louisiana. I, of course, from Nashville, Tennessee. Both of us, however, on the national debate circuit, so we go like all national debate circuit folks go to, you know, summer debate camps prepare for the coming year. And I met this young woman and in the manner of a 16, 17 year old over the course of the next several months fell in love. And naturally, when she said to me, you've got to go to Tulane, I said, yes, I'd never thought about going to Tulane. It wasn't even on my radar. I was going to go to Emory in Atlanta and the plan was to debate for them. But you know, this young woman said, oh, you can't do that. My God, if you go to college in Atlanta, we'll never see each other. You got to go to Tulane. You'll be in New Orleans. I'll be in Baton Rouge. It'll be great. And again, I changed my whole life trajectory for this relationship and ended up going to Tulane. Well, the relationship didn't end up working out. We dated for another year and broke up before sophomore year. But the point is, if I don't meet her, I don't go to Tulane. And if I don't go there, I don't meet those men. I don't get that job, et cetera. You know the story. And the only reason that I met her was the luck of going to that particular debate camp. There were others to which I could have gone, in which case I wouldn't have met her and I wouldn't have ended up at Tulane. And the fact that I was a debater in the first place, which didn't have to happen. In fact, when I started high school, that hadn't been my plan. When I started high school, I had planned to be a baseball player. That's what I did all my youth. I was really very good at it. I had had college recruiters, even at Little League games and Babe Ruth League games. So I sort of figured that was going to be my path. And yet when I tried out for the high school team, I had like this inexplicably horrible high school tryout. Get cut. And now I had to find a new activity. Well, that activity turned out to be speech and debate. If I make the baseball team, I'm not going to be doing that. And I'm not going to be at a debate camp over the summer. I'm going to be playing more ball during the summer of 1985 because that's going to be my path. I'm not going to have time for debate, certainly not at a national level, maybe as a hobby on the side or something locally, but not something that would send me to Washington, D.C. for debate camp where I would meet this young woman. And so if I make that baseball team, which by all rights, given my talent prior to that tryout, I should have, then I'm not going to be a debater. I'm not going to meet her. I'm not going to end up at Tulane. I'm not going to meet those two men who give me the job fighting David Duke, and the rest of history is going to be very, very different. Every one of you hearing this story has got some kind of story like that. We all do. We have stories about the things that happened in our life where if one thing goes differently, everything is different. And I know admitting that can be frightening because you begin to realize, my God, how different things could have gone. But think about how humbling it can be and think about how positive that humbling experience can be, right? Because number one, it allows you to truly be grateful for what it is you have. And a little bit of gratitude can go a long way toward making you a better person, right? Everybody says, oh, I'm so grateful for what I have. But if you actually believe that you've earned everything you have, you're not really grateful. What you're really, expressing gratitude for is your big brain. Like that's what Donald Trump says. I'm just so grateful that I'm so damn smart. Well, that's not humility. That's arrogance, right? If you're able to acknowledge the way luck has come into your life, the way unearned advantage has come into your life, whether it's racial or whether it's gendered or whether it's you were born into an upper middle class or affluent family, then you can actually sit back and say, okay, what are my obligations now vis-a-vis other people? Because if you think you did it all yourself, you're not going to think you have any obligations necessarily. You know, oh, maybe a charitable obligation. Maybe you need to help the poor because, you know, you're supposed to help the poor and that's what the Bible says. And so you'll go and you'll serve at the soup kitchen or you'll go and you'll build houses for the poor with Habitat for Humanity, all of which is fine, by the way, not knocking any of that. But if that's all you do, That's not humility at all. That's not actually trying to change this society. That's the difference between charity and solidarity, helping those who are less fortunate without acknowledging why you are more fortunate. On the other hand, if you start with an acknowledgement of how you became more fortunate, now you realize you've got to do something. You actually have to do something to try to change the society, to make it more fair, to make it more equitable at a systemic level, and even on an individual level. That humility calls us forth to do what? It calls us forth to actually be the mentor, to be the teacher, to be the friend, to be the person that opens the door for that other person and gives them an opportunity which they might otherwise not have had. So by crafting a counter narrative that pushes back, not just on Donald Trump's story, that one's relatively easy to debunk and has now been thoroughly debunked for anyone willing to look at it. But for those of us who are willing to push back on the larger American narrative of rugged individualism and the myth of meritocracy, if we can do that and do it effectively, we can begin to craft an understanding of our culture that points in the direction of solidarity and away from the hyper-competitive winner-take-all, I've got to beat you out at all cost mentality that has gotten us so deeply into the mess in which we now find ourselves. That's part of the way forward for us. It's not going to do all of the work for us, but unless we craft that narrative, unless we push back on this fundamental cornerstone of Americanism, we're never going to build a movement of economic solidarity, and we're never going to be able to deal with racism, and we're never going to be able to deal with sexism either, because those two will be rationalized. If you are told that wherever you end up is all about your own effort, and then you look around and see white folks disproportionately on the top, people of color disproportionately on the bottom, men disproportionately on the top of the hierarchies, women disproportionately on the bottom, there will always be the voice in your head that says that's natural, that seeks to rationalize it because the myth of meritocracy and individualism has told you that. We can do better than that. We can do better than a narrative that pits us against one another. We've got to have a narrative of solidarity rather than hyper-competitiveness. And I can think of no better time to begin crafting that than now in the era of Trumpism, especially as beholden as that notion of Trumpism is to the fake narrative of meritocracy. And that'll do it for another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Please join me again in 2 weeks for the next episode of the show. And in the meantime, you can check out my articles at medium.com, as well as my website, www.timwise.org. And follow the show on Facebook at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Instagram. Take care and join us again in 2 weeks. And the flames grow higher, and the poor and the pious get inspired.